this is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. These are the words that Jacob spoke, as we heard this morning, after his dream, when he raised up this standing stone, Bethel, which means the house of God. And the point of it was that it was where heaven and earth were connected. In his fascinating book, Folklore in the Old Testament, Sir James Fraser, the author of The Golden Bough, points out that there were many standing stones in Canaan at the time. Many of them were places of worship for the Jews. This was the most important of them. But typically they had a standing stone and next to it an altar where sacrifices were offered. And standing stones, menhirs, are some of the most ancient of all religious monuments. Some go back over 9,000 years. They precede the more organized henges like Stonehenge and the pyramids of Egypt. They were made more systematic in the obelisks of Egypt. Sacred masts are outside the major temples of India. Towers and spires are variants on this theme. Vertical structures that connect heaven and earth. These are not just symbolic. Of course it's symbolic that the top of it reaches up to the sky, the bottom is rooted in the earth. But they actually fulfill, as it were, a physiological role in the economy of Gaia. When lightning strikes the earth, which comes down from the heaven, it strikes the highest places. And it strikes the highest places on hilltops. Bethel was on a hilltop, and many of the great sacred places are on hilltops. And when they're not, they have towers and spires that raise them up above other things. Nobody really knows how lightning works. The theory that it's just, as it were, friction between clouds and the earth makes it rather local. But we now know that above the level of the clouds, there are sort of lightning strikes in the upper atmosphere called sprites. Sprites were only discovered fairly recently, and they show there's an electrical connection between the uppermost levels of the atmosphere, the clouds, and then some of this electricity comes down to the earth. And that electricity in the upper levels of the atmosphere is connected with the whole magnetic layers around the earth which deflect the solar wind and involves currents of electricity that come down to the earth from the sun. Lightning strikes really do connect heaven and earth in a way that's still rather mysterious. There's very little research done on them because you can't make them happen predictably. In the terminology of the language of law and the insurance business, they're called acts of God. Lightning strikes in this part of Cambridge have quite a choice, as do worshippers, because there are towers with lightning conductors on them at rather regular intervals. This very church has one on its tower. There are four on the pinnacles of King's College Chapel. There's Great St. Mary's. There's St. Botolph's. There's the Cambridge University Press Tower. So just in this small part of Cambridge, lightning has quite a choice of places to strike. In fact, there's quite a competition between sacred places with their towers reaching up to heaven. Lightning conductors, of course, are a fairly recent invention. They were invented in around 1750. One kind was invented in Europe, another in America by Benjamin Franklin. Before that, presumably the lightning would have had to make its way down through the stone or on the outside of the wet outside of the building. But these are literally places where the heaven and earth are connected. Not only do they attract the lightning, they protect buildings nearby. If you're near a place where lightning strikes, if there's a tall building there, it's more likely to strike it than it is to strike you. And nowadays, for those of us who are interested in lightning, the internet has brought a rather remarkable set of images. If you go onto YouTube and you look up lightning strikes, you can find hundreds of images that people have taken with video cameras at night during thunderstorms. And there's a particularly impressive one of the John Hancock Building in Chicago, which is an extremely tall skyscraper. And at its time, it was one of the fourth largest building in the world in the 70s. And as a thunderstorm goes over Chicago, there are lots of skyscrapers, but the Hancock Building stands out above all the others. And flash after flash hits the top of that building. You can see that they go down towards the others, but then this is the tallest and most attractive pathway for light, and they bend round and hit that one. So my first point is that these places, which are, as in Jacob's word, this is the gate of heaven, this is literally true of these tall buildings, and this has been so from the very beginning, the very first deliberately constructed religious monuments, which were menhirs. This has been there all along. The temple at Jerusalem was one such place. It's on Mount Moriah, the mountain where the Jews believe Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac when God intervened. And on that site was built the Temple of Jerusalem. The Temple of Jerusalem had two large towers, no doubt attractive of lightning. And to that place Jesus was taken for the Feast of the Presentation in the temple, where the oldest, the firstborn sons were taken for presentation in that holy place. The temple at Jerusalem played a major part in Jesus' life. His life circled around that holy place at the center of the Jewish religion. He challenged many things about the Jewish religion, but he didn't challenge the centrality of this sacred place. As well as sacred places, we have sacred times, and Candlemas, which falls tomorrow but is celebrated today, is one of them. Every year, the calendar is punctuated by sacred times, festivals, which reflect the changing quality of time throughout the year. A Christianity is a latecomer among religions, only 2,000 years old. Religions have been running for thousands of years by the time Christianity appeared on the scene, and all religions have sacred times and festivals. As is well known, many of the Christian festivals involved a Christianization of pre-existing festivals, and Candlemas is no exception. In Rome, it was a festival of Juno, when people went in processions carrying lights or candles in honor of the goddess. In the Celtic lands, it was Imbolc, which is one of the four fire festivals, which we now celebrate as Lammas in August, Candlemas, Halloween, or All Saints and All Souls Day, and then May Day. These four fire festivals were part of the traditional system of celebration here in Britain. So Candlemas incorporates these older festivals. And there's a traditional element in both sacred time and place, which precedes Christianity both in places and in times. But I don't think that's a bad thing at all. In fact, I think it's a wonderful thing that our religion is heir to these ancient traditions and continues them. And in fact, it's really only through these Christian practices today that these ancient festivals live on in our land, with the exception of Druids going to Stonehenge on the summer solstice. The vast majority of these festivals and the great majority of celebrations happen now in their Christian form. In Larkin's poem that we heard today, in his rather pessimistic, stripped-down, minimalist vision of sacred place, even he, an atheist, who was trying to find reasons to dismiss everything to do with church, admits and can't fail to recognize the sacredness of the place in this minimalist form. So this aspect of sacred place has not gone away, even for people like Philip Larkin. I have a theory about the way nature works, which is called morphic resonance, and it's the idea that similar things resonate with subsequent similar things. There's a kind of memory in nature. The so-called laws of nature are more like habits. And this applies to everything in nature. It applies to crystals, for example. If you make a new kind of crystal in Cambridge, then the same compound should crystallize more easily all around the world just because you've made it here. The more of it you make here, the easier it should get elsewhere. This is actually known to happen. Chemists usually explain it not in terms of morphic resonance, but in terms of little bits of crystals from here being carried around the world on the clothing or beards of migrant chemists, and or being wafted around as invisible dust particles in the atmosphere. But this is a testable aspect of the theory. It should happen even in the absence of migrant chemists or dust particles. The theory says if you train rats to learn a new trick in one place, then rats all around the world should learn it quicker just because they've learned it here. There's a collective memory in each species. There's evidence that rats indeed do exactly that. Even mice and all sorts of other animals do it. Pavlov, the great Russian physiologist, was one of the people who stumbled across this. He trained mice to run to a particular place to be fed. The first batch he trained took about 300 trials before they learned it. The second batch about 100, the next batch about 50. There was a rapid improvement. He couldn't explain it, so he simply dropped that line of research. But there's quite a lot of evidence that this actually does happen. And I think that this is relevant to the whole understanding of sacred places and times. When you enter a sacred place, as Philip Larkin did the church he described in that poem, or when you enter this sacred place, or any of the others that Cambridge has in such abundance, you enter a place where people have been before for hundreds of years, where people have prayed, where people have given thanks to God. And what happens when you enter that place, it looks the same, it smells the same as it did for people over a long period before. You enter into a kind of resonance with those who've been there before. So there's a kind of resonance of the place which is built up through that human experience within it. And of course, many sacred places are built on sites that have a particular property in the powers of the earth. Either they're places where lightning spontaneously strikes a lot, or where there's a particular quality of the earth which some people claim to detect through dowsing or other methods of geomancy. But just human usage alone and the habits that have been built up of worship there and experience there will give a connection through morphic resonance, through collective memory to that place. The same is true of sacred times. They fall at the same time of the year. Candlemas is always at the beginning of February. There's a particular quality of the year at those times. And of course, Christmas and the other great festivals fall at particular times of the year, which bring the human community into relationship with the cycles of the seasons, the cycles of the sun, and also the cycles of the moon. Easter and all the festivals associated with it are semi-lunar as well as solar. As you probably know, the Easter Sunday is the first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox. So it's anchored by the movements of the sun, but it's dependent on the phases of the moon, which is why it changes from year to year and all the festivals connected to it. These festivals link us to the cycles of the season and to the earth's relationship to the heavens, and also to the practice of the worshipping community over the years. All societies have seasonal festivals. And there again, morphic resonance, because of the similarity each year, would bring those who take part in them into connection with those who've done it before. This raises a more general point about the nature of rituals. All religions, all traditions have rituals. And rituals are normally a reenactment of some primal story of that community. The Passover festival of the Jews is a reenactment of the Passover dinner on that fateful night when the destructive power of God spread over Egypt and destroyed the firstborn of the Egyptians and the firstborn of their cattle, but passed over the Jews. They then left that destruction of the Egyptians, that those curses on Egypt were a blessing for Israel, and they left for their journey through the wilderness to the promised land. The Passover dinner reenacts that original dinner. The Christian Holy Communion, itself a Passover dinner, reenacts the Last Supper of Jesus with his disciples. And similar rituals occur in national or secular contexts. The American Thanksgiving dinner is a reenactment of the first harvest Thanksgiving of the American settlers in the New Land. So in these rituals, and in other rituals too, people do things the same way they've been done before. Rituals are generally conservative all around the world. They involve traditional languages, Sanskrit in the Brahminic rituals of India, ancient Egyptian in the Coptic rituals of the Egyptian church, Latin until recently in the Roman church. Here at St. Edward's, the Book of Common Prayer, the old form of language in the English church, Old Slavic in the Russian church. Ritual languages are conservative, and so is the form and structure of rituals. For rationalists, this just proves that religious believers are victims of superstition and mumbo-jumbo. But in the light of morphic resonance, it makes perfect sense. By deliberately doing things as similarly as possible to the way they've been done before, the past becomes present by morphic resonance. The present practitioners of those rituals are linked by morphic resonance to those who've done them before, right back to the very first time they were done. There's therefore a connection through time brought about through these rituals, which is exactly what those who take part in them think is happening. All traditional societies, especially those of Africa, I suppose, recognize that the present community is not all there is. The present community contains an invisible influence of those who've gone before, and indeed contains the seeds of those who come after. But there's an invisible presence of the ancestors. And indeed, we recognize that in the Christian tradition and in the creed, the phrase the communion of saints, to me, refers to this connection that we have with all those who practiced this faith before us and with whom we're connected through participating in Christian rituals. So, this ritual aspect through morphic resonance, I think, helps us to understand why we do the things we do and why they have the power they can have, why they can have that transformative power on us, because they take us outside our time and they connect us through what we're doing now to what's gone before in time and in place. Human beings need to be anchored in that way. Our individuality is very small compared with the larger society and tradition of which we're part. And those rituals link us to that and give us and strengthen and empower us through that connection. But religion and the spiritual life is more than just repetition. If it were nothing but ritual, it would be pure repetition. The interesting thing is it's through those structures that something new can happen. And the story of the presentation of Christ in the temple is in fact a perfect example of that. His parents were fulfilling the traditional law by which the firstborn son is presented in the temple. They went to the sacred place, they did the traditional rites, they presented a pair of turtle doves as a sacrifice. And this was on the place where Isaac was about to be sacrificed by Abraham, but instead an animal had been substituted. Interestingly, Jesus, at his presentation, a pigeon, a dove, is sacrificed, two doves. And there's a curious transformation, because at his baptism, the Holy Spirit descends as a dove. It's as if one of those sacrificial birds now comes back in a transmuted form, quite unexpected way. Also, through doing this regular ritual, and no doubt hundreds of firstborn children were brought every month to the temple, something new happened. And that's where Simeon, who had been waiting in the temple, who came into the temple and saw this happening, recognized something truly new was happening. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation. And about Jesus as a light to lighten the Gentiles and to be the glory of thy people Israel. This vision of something truly new coming through that ritual form is what Simeon saw. The sacrifice, the ritual sacrifice, the blood sacrifice that accompanied Jesus' presentation, which on the same place as the blood sacrifice of the ram that was a substitute for Isaac's, the human sacrifice of Isaac, was then transformed into Jesus' sacrifice in the crucifixion, which we commemorate in the Holy Communion. And at that moment, the veil of the temple was rent in twain. That itself affected what happened in that holy place where Jesus had been presented. So something else can come through these ritual forms, through that connection which links us and gives us our identity. The creative spirit of God can work in and through us, and does in many people's lives. And that again brings us back to the image of lightning. Every church in Cambridge is, as it were, awaiting those lightning strikes that connect the church to the holy place, make it a gate of heaven. But we can't predict when they'll come next. I don't know whether the church wardens of St. Edward's keep a record of lightning strikes on St. Edward's, but presumably they happen. Otherwise, the money spent on the lightning conductor that runs down that side of the tower would have been wasted. So we never know when the lightning is going to strike a sacred place. But there are certain things about the sacred place that make it more likely it will have that connection. One of them is having the tower. Another is actually having a lightning conductor, because they make it more likely that lightning will strike by giving it a conductive pathway. They actually attract lightning. And we don't know in our own lives when those particular moments of inspiration from the Holy Spirit will come to us. Because the Holy Spirit, like the wind and like the lightning, is unpredictable. But we can create a framework in which that can happen. A framework which can sustain and help us through the observation of sacred places, sacred times, and the rituals of our tradition. Through all of us, the Holy Spirit can work. And I want to end just with those opening words, the words of Jacob. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven.